Welcome to the official podcast of the Hoffeld Group. Your host is the CEO and Chief Sales Trainer of the Hoffeld Group, David Hoffeld.
Welcome to the official podcast of the Hoffeld Group, where we provide you with powerful sales insights that are based upon proven science and will help you sell more. I'm your host, the CEO and Chief Sales Trainer at the Hoffeld Group, David Hoffeld.
Today we have a very special guest, Ed Tate. Ed won the World Championship of Public Speaking in 2000, and he is a successful trainer, speech coach, and international keynote speaker. He's a seasoned executive who is known worldwide as the speaker who energizes, educates, and entertains. Ed is a coach to individuals, businesses, Fortune 500 companies, sales teams, entrepreneurs throughout the United States and globally. And in my opinion, he is one of the top speech coaches in the country. And if you want to improve your sales presentations, Ed's insights are something that you need to know. Ed, it's great to have you with us today.
David, thank you very much. And wow, what an introduction. Boy, I'm listening to the introduction. Man, I want to hear from this guy. You know, he sounds pretty good.
I'm always selling it. So let's jump right into it. A question I wanted to pose to you that a lot of our listeners can really relate to is salespeople will often work hard to get a meeting with buyers and earn the right to make a formal presentation, but then they lose their buyer's attention in the first few minutes of that presentation. So I wanted to pose to you, what are some strategies that will help salespeople engage buyers at the beginning, in the first few minutes of that presentation?
Okay. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, and just if you could role play with me for a second to help set the context,
sure.
And then I'll answer the question. So generally speaking, when is a salesperson at a presentation the most nervous, at the beginning, the middle, or the end?
I would say probably right at the beginning, right when they're getting up there to present.
So generally speaking, when is the buyer the most skeptical? Generally speaking, at the beginning, the middle, or the end?
I would say, again, probably at the beginning of the presentation.
Okay, that's a bad combination. Wouldn't you agree?
I would, yes.
So because of that dynamic, and that dynamic is also true in presentations, generally the presenter or the speaker is the most nervous at the beginning of the presentation. The audience is the most nervous. It's a very, very bad dynamic. So there's several things that they must take place at the beginning. Number one, you've got to break preoccupation. And what I mean by that is you have to grab and keep your audience members, or in this case, your buyer's attention from the very beginning. And then right after you break their attention, you have to frame the message. That is, in one sentence or less, or maybe possibly even two sentences or less, basically, why are you there and what specifically is in it for that particular buyer? So break preoccupation and frame the message. If you cannot frame the message, frame your talk in one sentence or less, you're not clear and you probably won't make the sale. So you have to articulate that, and then jump into it. You know, no preamble, no pre-ramble. So again, frame the message, break preoccupation, frame the message, and just jump into the content. Also, additionally, I'm inviting salespeople to memorize their opening and their close. Again, memorize that their opening, whatever it is going to be for that particular event, and also how they're going to close. What that does is it gives you confidence. If you know how you're going to open and you know how you're going to close that presentation, it provides you with a great deal of confidence. A couple other things. Let me give you a couple of examples. There was an executive with Johnson & Johnson. Now, I was competing for the business, actually, to coach this particular C-level executive vice president with Johnson & Johnson. Go on LinkedIn. I discovered that she is a Penn State alum. Not only is she a Penn State alum, she is a loyal Penn State alum. I had actually spoken at Penn State a couple of months prior to that. Now, I'm a University of Illinois graduate. We're both part of the Big Ten. I will never, ever put on the Penn State paraphernalia. I'm pretty sure my skin would burn, you know. But anyway, I had this box of stuff, and I said to myself, hey, as opposed to throwing it away, why don't I give it to her? So what I do is I packed it all up, this Penn State paraphernalia, and it was quite a bit. I put it in a box, and I mailed it to – I FedExed it to her. So number one, she accepts my call right away. Number two, we spend the first 15 minutes talking about Penn State. And then I talked about, you know, I was from the University of Illinois, and then she proceeded to harass the fact that our football team is really, really bad. So we got humor. But, you know, I want you to look at the dynamic here. The first 20 minutes of that call, she did almost all the talking. And typically, most salespeople, in my opinion, where they fail, and myself early in my career, is I did most of the talking as opposed to letting them talk. So there's a couple dynamics here. Number one, break preoccupation. Number two, frame the message. Number three, jump into the contact. Those are the principles. How did I break preoccupation? I did some research and some homework, and I found out about her. And then what I did is I did something creative out of the box. I literally took a box of Penn State sweatshirts, T-shirts, you name it, et cetera, and I sent it to her. Guess what? It was a surprise. She wasn't expecting anything like that. I immediately separated myself from the pack. I also showed her that I did homework, and I was willing to work hard to separate myself from the pack. So I and that eventually led to a $50,000 worth of business. I won the business when I broke the preoccupation. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's breaking through that little barrier there. And there's so much, there's a lot of takeaways in what you just said there. But I think to summarize it all up, it's that intentionality. I think oftentimes, to your point, salespeople go into a presentation and they're mostly winging it. But you're saying memorize the beginning, memorize the end of the presentation. It's going to boost confidence. Look for ways to build rapport. Communicate clearly in that sentence what's in it for the buyer. Why should they listen? Giving them that compelling reason to grab their attention and see what's in it for them. So focusing on your buyers, I think those are some – that's a powerful takeaway, and that's a great example of it. Yeah.
Every buyer is different. Every sales situation is different. For example, my mindset is, for example, there's a program I have. It's called, you know, Making Managers into Leaders. I've taught this program 200 times. But, you know, I've never taught this program on this day and before this specific audience. And I'm inviting your listeners to think, hey, I've never presented this product or this service to this particular individual on this particular day. So what I need to do is I need to make it special. I need to customize it. I don't wing it or don't go into your habitual habit pattern by treating that particular buyer like the herd. We live in a day and age where people want to be treated like individuals. I mean, just, you know, it used to be we used to go to department stores and you could find everything. But now every store is customized. For example, my wife's favorite store is, God, I can't think of the name off of the top of my head. But like the only thing they do is sell soap. You know, that's the only thing they sell is soap. I mean, can you imagine, you know, 10 or 15 years ago just having a soap store, you know? But, you know, if you go into malls nowadays, every store is customized. Well, there's a reason for that, because people, by and large, want to be treated like individuals. They don't want to be treated like the herd.
That's a great point as well, and that's a foundational part of influence, really, is understanding another person's perspective. It's very hard to influence someone effectively or really meet their needs until you understand them and that intentionality. That's a great insight and a powerful reminder for everyone in sales and in life in general. It's almost impossible to effectively influence someone if you don't understand their perspective, because to your point, you fall into those old habits and you basically sell the way you would want to be sold to, but you're not the buyer. Everyone is unique.
Here's another powerful tip that has been helpful for me. I use Twitter as a listening tool. Now, not all I typically go after C-level executives. That's my niche. That's my target market. And the ones who tweet, it is absolutely amazing the insights you can gain into someone who actually uses Twitter or social media. Because what they're doing is they're telling the world basically how to sell to them. You know, they're telling you what's important to them. So for me, for my customers and clients, Twitter is a great listening tool. And one of the things, if I have a targeted account, the one thing I want to do is I want to research them. I'm going to do, you know, your basics on social media, et cetera. I have a Hoover's account. So what I can't find on social media or the internet, I'll look on Hoover's. And if they have a Twitter account, I'm going to follow them on Twitter, because you don't need permission to follow them on Twitter, and you'll gain great insights into their thought processes.
That is yet another really important takeaway, because you're exactly right. Most high-level executives, when they tweet, it's their actual tweets. No one else is doing it. So you really can get some great insights. That's a really good takeaway. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Let me ask another question. One thing my first time I saw you speak, I was really struck by this, and it's that you are a master of using strategic pauses to improve the impact of what you say. And oftentimes, we as salespeople, we don't really think about pauses. In fact, we try to ignore them and put filler words in. We feel uncomfortable in the pause. But can you give our listeners some insights into why pauses are so important, and then how do you execute them effectively?
Let's see. Number one, pauses show confidence. By pausing and allowing your buyer to think about your products and your services, number one, it illustrates confidence. So that's the number one thing that it does. I have, for the past 15 years, have been working with companies like, you know, pharmaceutical firms like Johnson & Johnson, GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca, et cetera. And we work with their leadership development program. So they've identified what we call these hotshot MBA, PhD candidates who come into their companies. Very bright, very smart individuals in their early to mid-20s. And our job is to help them with their presentation skills. And the one thing that literally undermines them is the fact that they fill the room with words with no pauses whatsoever. In fact, the more you talk, the more it says to someone who has more experience than yourself is that you lack confidence because you're trying to fill the room with words. So the biggest benefit of pausing is it shows confidence. Number two, it allows people to go into their own world. So if you ask them, a tool that I use is called effective questions. Effective questions is basically it's a how or what question and the direction of your goal, where you want the customer or the client to think. So I always try to ask them a question. Well, they can't think of an answer if I'm still talking. So I'll ask them an effective question, and I will shut up until they say something. And sometimes salespeople, they undermine themselves because they don't have the ability to shut up. Stop talking and focus on listening. My goal, every time I have an interaction with a potential customer or client, be it in person or on the phone, is the goal is 75-25. And that is, they talk 75% of the time, I talk 25% of the time. And this is something I've just learned over the years. Anytime I mess with that equation and I talk more than that, it either takes me longer to get the deal or I don't get the deal. So, again, I'm just talking about myself. I know what my percentages are, and my goal always is to have them talk more than I do by asking them an open-ended question. So, and that's the power of the pause. And again, like I said, it shows confidence, it shows authority, and it's also verbal punctuation and emphasis. So when you use a pause as a strategic tool, a tool of influence, at the right time, at the right moment, then, you know, again, it has dramatic impact on people. So the last question you had was how can people actually, you know, get better at pausing? Well, there's a couple places. Number one, in your presentations, you know, practice them. Practice them in front of a camera as opposed to a mirror. Practice your presentations out loud. Get together with some of your colleagues. And there's a difference between drills and a scrimmage. Okay, a drill is, you know, like if you played sports, you would practice, you know, like let's say basketball. I'm just throwing that out. You would practice, you know, dribbling with your left hand, dribbling with your right hand. You would practice free throws. So they're very, very specific skills. A scrimmage is, it's a live game where you actually see how you can actually implement and execute that. So the thing I would invite you to do is both of those things, you know, and incorporate this technique of a scrimmage, get together with maybe your sales team, et cetera. Maybe join a Toastmasters group and start speaking in front of nonprofit organizations where you can practice your presentations live. Speaking presenting, persuading, and influencing is an active skill. You must practice this skill out loud in front of people in order to see or test your effectiveness. You cannot do this mentally inside your head.
Yeah, and again, a number of different very practical takeaways there from the pausing, how to execute it. I know one of the things I did early on when I was working in this a number of years ago, working on getting, because it can feel awkward at first having that pause there, but you're mm-hmm. right, it allows your buyers the space to think, it conveys confidence, and I think that's what struck me about the way you use the pause is the confidence, and it grabs people's attention too, it really does. But I remember I would actually, when I would write out a speech early on in my career, I would actually put a place and remind myself as I practiced, you pause here, so that I began to train myself and force myself to actually do that, because it was so almost counterintuitive early on. But once you begin to do it, it becomes second nature, and you see the power of it, to your point.
Absolutely. And you know what buyers buy? They buy confidence. They don't buy your products or your service. They buy confidence or belief in what you're selling. Yeah. And if you come across that way, That'll help you a long way in terms of actually closing the deal.
Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, that kind of transitions nicely, I know one of the things you have said is that you shouldn't look at a speech or a presentation as a presentation, but really as a small play. And I thought that was such a fascinating thing. Can you flesh that out for our listeners and maybe explain how that mindset will inspire them or help them be more effective presenters?
Mm-hmm. More specifically, I look at stories as small plays, because sometimes this particular strategy doesn't work in every circumstance. And the thing I'm inviting your listeners to do is use your best judgment under all circumstances. But I look at stories as a small play, and stories are sticky. You know, if you tell a story, they're very, very sticky. I call it tweetable, repeatable. If you tell a really good story, then, you know, people are going to be repeating that story. So, for example, years ago, I was speaking in front of GlaxoSmithKline. I was the opening keynote speaker, and this was in Seattle. I blew the doors off. It was one of those magical moments. The president of this particular division says, "Hey, my people love you, Ed. Could you be our closing speaker?" And there was a problem. The problem was I'd used up all my good material. But I had 4 days to come up with a closing presentation, and I discovered something completely by accident. So I started to interview some of the salespeople and ask them about their challenges, etc. And I met this guy. I believe his name is Robert. And I says, "Robert, how did you become – to work for GlaxoSmithKline?" He says, "Well, when I graduated from school in, I believe it was North Carolina," he said, "I worked for Philip Morris, the cigarette company." And he said, "That was my first job out of school." He says, "One day my son, Tyler, who was in kindergarten, it was show and tell. And basically you were supposed to tell what your parents did for a living. So when it came to his mom," he says, "his mom's a nurse and she helps people get better. But when it came to dad, he told the teacher and the class he couldn't remember." Well, the teacher calls up mom. Mom calls up Robert and says, "You need to talk to Tyler." Well, anyways, it turns out Tyler was so embarrassed that his dad worked for a cigarette company, he would rather say that he forgot rather than tell his teacher or his classmates. And much to Robert's credit, he resigned, and he eventually started working for GlaxoSmithKline. Now, the problem today is Robert has to tell Tyler why daddy sells drugs for a living. And, well, anyway, I was expecting like a little chuckle just like you gave me right there. I got a 4-minute standing ovation.
Wow.
I got to tell you, David, I was stunned. I was thinking like, okay, I thought it was kind of cute. I thought I'd get a chuckle. But I got a 4-minute standing ovation. And a buddy of mine, he used to say this, he said he called it the great aha, Roger Millott. And the great aha for me was this. Number one, that story was not perfect. But you know what? It was about them. And it was something – it was like almost like an inside joke there. I accidentally tapped into their world and tapped into a joke that in their world. And that little story where, you know, his son and Robert were the hero, I said to myself, ah, and I've been using this principle ever since. And the principle is the story does not have to be perfect. It has to be about them. I will tell you, that is perhaps – my rehire rate is in excess of 80%. Ever since I've been using this principle of telling a story about them, I've been rehired on the average 80%. So if salespeople, if you can tell a story about them, about their service, about one of their people, about one of their clients, and how it was successful, you will also be successful as well. So to me, that's one of the keys of telling the story. Now, getting back to the original question, that is a small play. And what I mean by that is there's several things that I do. For example, my championship speech is called One of Those Days. And basically, it starts off with me getting a speeding ticket on my way to catch a plane. I missed the flight because of two things. Number one, I got the speeding ticket. Number two, DIA, Denver International Airport, had just opened up, and the airlines decided it would be a good idea to actually enforce a two-bag limit. Prior to that, if you killed a deer, you could bring it on the plane. I mean, that's how loose they were. And there were lines, as you know, it was like after post 9/11. You remember the lines at the airport then? Very similar circumstances. Yeah. So that's scene number one, is I get a ticket. Scene number two, I'm at the airport. There's no way I'm going to make my flight. Scene number three, I'm a little arrogant. I'm a 1K with United Airlines, and I said to myself, you know, I see that there's a 2 o'clock flight leaving, and because of my status and my indignation, you know, I want to actually talk to someone face-to-face as opposed to talking to them on the phone, and they better get me on that flight. Anyway, I'm practicing what I'm going to say to the customer service representative. And it's like God says, okay, Ed, this is what this is going to look like. And the person in front of me says almost verbatim everything I'm going to say except for the following. He calls the woman the B word. Oh. And the silence was deafening. And then he storms off. And all of a sudden, you know, there are several things that occurred to me. Number one, how silly I would have looked had I done the same thing he did. I had no intentions of ever name-calling, so let's be clear about that. The other thing that occurred to me is I was so stunned by what this guy said, how come I didn't say anything in the moment? Because it was so rude. You know, and the woman behind the counter was just trying to help the guy out. She had nothing to do with him missing his connection, none of these things. She was just trying to help the guy out, and the guy just treated her like the lowest of the low. And so anyway, I literally said, hey, you know, ma'am, I understand that, you know. And he was – by the way, I was trying to get on the same flight that he was. I said, look, put me on any flight today. That'll be fine. And anyway, she actually put me on the flight that she did not put him on. There's another story there. Then I go to the gate, and one of the things – I'm a frequent flyer, and one of the things that I notice is, you know, typically a gate's operated by uniformed personnel. In addition to the uniformed personnel, there's a person in a suit. And usually when you're traveling, you see a person behind the gate, but with a suit on, it usually means trouble. Long story short is this suit is a supervisor. He actually had heard how I actually had graciously treated one of his own people. I actually confronted that guy a little bit later on, the guy who had yelled at the woman. And, you know, I did it because I felt it was the right thing to do. Well, anyway, they upgrade me to first class, not only that flight, but the next five flights. And anyway, this story takes place in five different scenes. Scene number one, the police officer gives me a ticket. Scene number two, I'm at the airport. There's no way I'm going to make my flight. Scene number three, the confrontation between the angry young man and the customer service agent. Scene number four, I actually confront this guy. And I said, you know, next time this happens, just be nice. And then scene number five is I'm actually at the gate. Well, what I didn't realize is apparently another employee of that airline had witnessed me confronting this guy, and they actually told the supervisor, and you know, the rest is as they say, is history. So that's how I saw it. And when I saw it from that perspective, these different scenes, it was easier to tell the story. The other thing too is the biggest mistake that people make in terms of telling stories is they talk too much. I want your listeners to I'm going to repeat this, but I want them to write this down. People place action resolution. People place action resolution. If you're telling a story, get the characters out right away. So whoever is in the story, get the main characters. So say, for example, you're telling a story, five people in the car, it only involves two, only talk about the two, skip the other three. The other three, they're a distraction. You want to you want to take out the boring parts of stories, okay? Mm-hmm. And not every part of a story is important. So, you know, get the characters out of the way right away and get the location out of the way. So in this case, I'm at an airport. It really didn't matter which airport. It was an airport. So in this case, I could have just said, hey, I was on my way to an airport. I got a speeding ticket on my way to an airport. By the time I got to the airport, there were lines for as far as I could see. I'm not going to make my flight. Boom. Guess what I've done? I've within seconds, I've identified what the circumstances are and the location. Now you want to spend the majority of your time on the action and the resolution. So in this case, if salespeople tell a story about your customer, your client, or tell a story, you know, about, you know, the traditional feel, felt, and found, or, you know, stories about your other customers and clients who felt the same way, and this is what the results they received by, you know, pursuing this particular path that you're recommending. But make sure the story is under 2 minutes. In business, you know, in Toastmasters, we have 5 to 7 minutes. In a business setting, that's way too long. So it's got to be 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, but that's the extent of it. But if you can tell your content or in a story type of method, it's going to make your message sticky as opposed to lecture or what I call a data dump.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's, again, some very thought-provoking, very practical insights there. And you demonstrated them well. I would encourage our listeners to listen to what Ed said again about stories and the way he demonstrated them, because that was very powerful. Thank you for sharing that with us. I guess that maybe brings up another component of maybe seeing the story or the whole presentation as a play, and that is one that's very rarely talked about in the world of sales, but is extremely important. There's some very compelling research on this, and that is nonverbal communication. Mm-hmm. I wanted to maybe ask you for some insights for our listeners, because oftentimes we don't think about that. We focus so much on what we're saying that we miss how we say it, and sometimes our nonverbal signals will sabotage our words. So what are some ways that salespeople can improve their nonverbal communication?
Yeah. Several things. Number one is, I don't know if it's possible, but if you, again, in your scrimmages, in your rehearsals, in your practices, where you're actually doing a full-blown rehearsal of your presentation to a very important client, I would invite you to videotape it. The reason you want to videotape it is you'll see some of those nonverbals. For example, by the way, this is how you watch the video. There's 4 steps to watching a video. And by the way, for those of you who are listening, I want you to repeat after me. I look like that. I sound like that. Get over it. Okay? So we had to look and listen. Now it's your turn. All right? So, okay, just get over it. Number one, don't watch the video. Listen to the video. Listen to your words. Can I follow your entire presentation without actually seeing you? Okay. Are you using pauses, or are you just using a burst of words? Are you attacking or assaulting your prospect with words? So number one, listen to your presentation. Don't watch it. Number two, watch your presentation without sound. Do you come across as confident? Do you own the stage? Do you come across as, again, confident? Do you have swagger? I'm a tennis player. I'm your average tennis player, but I win 90% of my matches. And I'm in my 50s. I play guys in their 20s. And the reason I beat these guys is because tennis, like sales, is a mental game. It is a mental game. And the one thing I do is swagger. I've got swagger. Here's another aside. I went to the U.S. Open a few years ago, saw Serena Williams play. and the most interesting example of swagger and body language I've ever seen in my life. They introduce her opponent. Her opponent, she waves to the crowd, she has a smile. And then they introduce Serena. And Serena's got swagger. And you see the crowd, you know, they cheer for her. And I look at her opponent, and literally before the first ball was tossed, I told my friend, she lost the match. And they says, hey, how do you know that? A ball hasn't been played. I says, she lost the match. She's already done. Because I can see it in her face that she has mentally, she had already lost it. So the other thing is have swagger. You know, be confident about the product and service that you have. Here's my mindset about my products and services. It is a criminal offense if my prospect does not buy my product or service. I have committed a crime against humanity if they don't buy my product or service. That's how strongly I feel about my products and services. And if you don't feel that way about your products and services, you need to do something else, to be perfectly frank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really, really do. Okay? So that's one thing, nonverbal communication. Here's something else, dress the part. Dress the part. I wear, you know, $1,000 suits. I wear cufflinks. I don't wear regular shirts. My shirts are dry cleaned, okay, with a crisp collar, et cetera. I wear very expensive shoes. It's because I feel like I'm putting, like if I were Superman, a Marvel comic character, that's my suit. That's my uniform. That's my Superman outfit. So you have to put on your Superman, you have to put on your Superwoman outfit to help you with your swagger. Will it help you close deals and sales? Absolutely not. But it definitely helps with confidence. And what did I say earlier? People buy confidence. Here's something else. This is probably the most unusual tip you're ever going to hear, and it's completely nonverbal. There's a buddy of mine. His name is Pete Moyer. And David, here's someone that you really should interview. I may be overstating his successes, but I know he's one of the top gasoline pump salespersons on earth. Okay, I'll connect you with him, and he's just absolutely fascinating. But he's got this one technique. You know, like it takes, you know, I'm sure you've heard the numbers. It takes anywhere from 7 to 12 to nowadays maybe even 15 contacts in order to gain rapport with someone before they feel comfortable buying from you. Pete's got this unusual technique that accelerates that process. It condenses it in one sales call. And I don't know what he calls it, to be honest with you. So, again, I'm going to have him speak for himself. But what he does is if he's meeting a prospect or a client for the first time, he will make an excuse to leave the room. So he will say, hey, can I get a cup of coffee? Can I go to the restroom? Hey, can I request a brochure? Can I get a tour? What he wants to do is he's met the person. He wants to leave the room and then come back in. He says, psychologically, now it's the second meeting. And then he says, if he can, he wants to make another excuse to leave the room and come back again. He says, psychologically, now it's the third meeting. He says he cannot tell you the number of times that and if he can, he wants to do it. He says, on the average, he averages 3 times, you know, where he leaves the room and comes out of the room 3 times. He says, if he can push the 4, he'll push it. He says, but what happens is people, their body posture, their nonverbal communication goes from standoffish to all of a sudden they're laughing and joking with them. So it is probably the most unusual nonverbal tip you've ever heard. And again, it's not my idea. It's a buddy of mine. His name is Pete Moyer.
Very practical takeaways for our listeners there to focus on that nonverbal. And you gave some great strategies that they can employ today to make that a priority, because it does impact what we say and the way we present so much, both from our perspective, as you mentioned, with confidence, but also perception of others, like dress. There's a lot of great research on that, how what you wear impacts how you're perceived. Whether that's fair or unfair is irrelevant, because it is reality. And that's what we want to do in salespeople, is focus on that. So, again, some great takeaways there. One question I wanted to ask you as well that you kind of talked about briefly a little while ago was practice. There's a lot of compelling research from behavioral science on deliberate practice and how it's one of the keys to success in really doing almost anything, but especially delivering high-impact presentations. And you've kind of talked about that intentionality and practicing, but what are some specific tips that you can give our listeners on how do they practice productively? How do they practice in a way that's going to heighten their performance when game day comes?
Mm-hmm. I always love the story, and for those of you who follow sports, you've heard this before. But back in May, let's say, I think it was May of 2002, there used to be this basketball star. His name is Allen Iverson. He was an NBA All-Star. He played for the Philadelphia 76ers. And he had this rant, and he says, "We're talking about practice. We're sitting here talking about practice, not the game, but we're talking about practice." And he was bemoaning the fact that, you know, people were criticizing his effort during practice. Now, let's contrast his mindset with that of John Wooden. For those of you who don't know who John Wooden is, the American basketball coach, he won 10 NCAA college national championships in a 12-year period, an all-time record. And Mr. Wooden, his philosophy about practice, he says, "I'm not a strategic coach, I'm a practice coach. How you run the race, your planning, your preparation, your practice, and your performance counts for everything. Winning and losing is a byproduct and an after effect of that effort. Practice is literally everything." So in the presentation sphere, I've got about a dozen tips here. So tip number one is practice in front of a camera, not a mirror. A camera will show you, it's probably the number one tool as in terms of your presentation skills, your sales skills, etc. If you don't hire a coach and you just want to self-evaluate yourself, a camera never lies. You can see how you come across and you can make changes. So number one, do it with a camera. If you practice in front of a mirror, practice in front of a mirror so you can see your gestures. Again, your hand gestures or maybe distracting gestures. For example, there was an executive who I was coaching, and he had this very bad habit of playing patty cake with his thighs. He would take both of his hands, and he would just hit his thighs. And I asked him, "Why do you do that?" And he says, "Why do I do what?" I says, "Let's go to the camera." And one of the things that we did is we actually sped up the camera and fast forward motion, like, mm-hmm. You know, 400%. And literally, it looked like he was applauding with his thighs. He never did it again. Okay? Practice like you play. And so one of the things I invite people to do is if you're having a scrimmage, go through the scrimmage all the way. Don't stop if you make a mistake. Don't stop if you, you know, literally practice like, hey, this buyer's in front of me. There's no timeout when you're talking to the buyer. So when you're rehearsing, there shouldn't be a timeout either unless you're doing drills, very, very specific drills. Let's see. Avoid perfection. We're looking for success. We're looking for success, not perfection. And especially technical presenters, they get caught up in what I call the weeds or the minutiae. So, you know, what you want to do is you want to be conversational as opposed to presentational. Presentational is inauthentic. There's a reason why YouTube is so successful today. It's because people are having conversations as opposed to presentations. Now, here's a couple drills I'm going to provide for you. You know, practice your openings, your transitions to your first point, your transitions to your next point, and your closes. Practice these things out of order. So that way you internalize as opposed to memorizing your content. Practice different parts of your presentation, your stories. If you're giving some type of training or directions, practice your instructions. Here's a place where I see people falter over and over again is the directions they give people. They haven't practiced their directions. Practice your delivery. If you have analogies or metaphors, practice those just by themselves. And also practice presenting your data. By the way, people don't want data. What they want is insights. So give people your insights, not data. Numbers by themselves are not memorable. However, insights are. Insights are. Results are, stories are. So practice your insights. And then with regard to practice, make it fun. You know, it shouldn't be monotony. It shouldn't be drudgery. Have fun with it. The more fun you have, you know, practicing and rehearsing. And again, I distinguish between a scrimmage and drills. But make sure that somehow you have fun with them.
Excellent. Well, and you have given us so many very practical strategies. strategies and tactics that our listeners can employ today. If our listeners do want to learn more about you and the resources that you provide, where can they go?
Just go to my website, edtate.com, edtate.com, and just look me up from there.
Well, thank you so much, Ed, and thank you for sharing those fascinating and very actionable insights with us. And make sure to join us here next time on the HuffO Group podcast. And remember, as always, selling is just too important to be based on anything other than proven science. We'll see you next time.